football on Off the Ball.
I think there's an interesting thing goes on when you have coaches who try to control so much, when they try to take the emotion out of it, when they try to make it data-driven. That leads to a loss of faith from fans in their players' abilities.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Versus Shelton. No chance. 2-2. Kempis' second goal, and Shelton was left without a hope.
Mario Kempes, the star of Argentina's first World Cup triumph in 1978, scored a whopping 303 goals over the course of his career, which included spells at Valencia, Rosario Central, River Plate and Instituto. But what if his career had taken a different path and ended up at Spurs? Well, just years after helping his nation win their first World Cup, he nearly joined his fellow countrymen in Ozzy Ardiles and Ricky Villa at the North London club. But why didn't the deal get over the line? Well, in episode 4 of Richie McCormack's Sliding Doors, Richie explains why the transfer didn't come to fruition for one of the best strikers in the world of the 70s and 80s. Find this week's episode in your OTB Football podcast feed for free each and every Monday. You can also go back and listen to the other episodes in this series focusing on Michael Laudrup, Pelé and Ronaldo. Subscribe in your OTB Football podcast feed now.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Centra. Kick off with a cold one. Over 18s only. Drink responsibly. Get the facts. Visit drinkaware.ie.
This is News Talk.
22nd of February 2026. What a beautiful Sunday it is. You're very welcome along to the Sunday Paper Review. Adrian with you and in the company of Orla McEnroy, sports editor of the Irish Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday. Orla, how are you doing?
Great.
We've all got a pep in our step today.
Couldn't be better.
Brendan Hackett is a former intercounty manager of Offaly, Longford, Westmeath, worked with several other intercounty teams in his role as a sports psychologist, managed Ballymun Kickhams, former CEO of Athletics Ireland, currently head coach and player head of coach and player development with the GAA. Brendan, how are you?
Very good, Adrian.
Thanks many for coming in. That's a long,
nice introduction.
Eating up half of our podcast time there with that introduction. But it's worth mentioning all those things, and you're both very welcome. And what a day it is as well to get stuck into the papers today. So we'll do that in just a moment. The paper review today on Off the Ball with in partnership with Centra. Make sure that your fridge is match ready to kick off with a cold one. Over 18s only. Drink responsibly. Get the facts. And visit drinkaware.ie. Let's tell you what's going on. This is the thing that you want to see across the sports pages today. We're going to start with the Mail on Sunday. A special day, it exclaims across the back page here. Farrell hails spirit of players as Ireland run riot in London. And it's all 6'7" of James Ryan piling on top of his players, Tadhg Byrne and others, in the aftermath of the game at Twickenham yesterday. You know, as if you haven't had enough of a grueling 80 or 90 minutes. 18 stone of James Ryan landing on top of you is exactly what you want if you're Jack Crowley and others on the pitch, as more reflections inside from Rory Keane and others. Rebel Ram is Ryder Cup doubt as he rejects peace deal, is the other line there that we get to in just a little bit. The Sunday Independent have gone with floating on air. Ireland roll back the years to demolish England, and it's Robert Balakoon crashing over for his try yesterday. I love how he's kind of like giving the eyes to the photographer there, hasn't he?
Right.
Looks like he's sort of like, you know, I'm just cruising here. So much so. Look, get this one. Get this picture. I mean, I'm presuming that's not what he's thinking, but
no.
It kind of looks a little bit like that. The Sunday Times is ruthless Ireland demolish England for their biggest ever victory at Twickenham. More thoughts inside on that 42-21 victory. Record breakers screams the headline there. And Jamie Osborne screaming away from the England defence, scrambling England defence there. Then the other story here in the bottom from Paul Roan, FAI probes collapse of teenagers' record transfer. The family of the most highly rated young player in Ireland, Shamrock Rovers teenager Michael Noonan's, made an official complaint to the authorities following the collapse of what would have been a record-breaking €2 million move to Hoffenheim. You'll remember all this was reported over the last couple of months. But Paul Rowan writes, the complaint was made by Noonan's mother, Sandy, a Kildare-based businesswoman. Football Association of Ireland confirmed on Friday that she'd made a complaint to the Football Association in London The FAA then informed the FAI of the complaint. The matter is also under investigation by the international governing body, FIFA. The FAI has sought an explanation from Shamrock, as it says here, and repeatedly so. Rovers, as I think they tend to be called. The club are believed to have provided a full response, laying out all the facts as they view them. And Noonan's agent, David Moss, has it his say here in the piece as well, said that he was the victim of a smear campaign. Lots of quotes from him, including, "I've always worked in the best interest of Michael and the Noonan family and will continue to do so." That one is was an unexpected one this morning, and you can expect that to run and run, you would think, over the next little while as well. The Sun, meanwhile, goes Taoiseach and awe. Ireland robbed to record rout. Martin hails Andy's heroes. It's just what you want, isn't it? And your sports pages is, you know, quotes from the Taoiseach after, after a win like that. Anyway, that's where the Sun have gone with that. And also Tony Green and gold. So Tony Brosnan with the goal for Kerry as they beat Dublin in a pretty drab affair, 116. To 110, that's on the Sun. The Mirror goes Green Party. Awesome Ireland run right in record win at Twickenham. Kingdom drabbed the points at the top there as well on that Tony Brosnan goal. That was the Mirror. And then the People says, "I want Warriors." Arteta tells Gunners, "Go and do something else if you can't handle the title pressure." He wants Warriors, not Whiners, turns out. And just to mention, one of the broadsheets that's gone with the picture on the front page as well is the Sunday Times. It is that hulking James Ryan, jolly green giants. It's not to be resisted on a day like this, towering above his teammates. So that's give you a bit of a sense of what's happening across the back pages today. I saw the Sun during the week and wondered to myself, where did that come from? And I wondered if it's here to stay. And I found myself asking myself the same question after the game yesterday.
Maybe Andy Farrell gave it a talking to. Like, it seems to have worked. Whatever he said to a number of his players has just, you know, worked and brought them back into... Like, you can go through the team from 15 to 1, can't you? And just say, like, you, there's something complimentary to say about each one, and there's a heroic intervention by every member of that team at some point during the game. It was just an outstanding performance. It's great to be sitting here and dissecting such a performance as that.
Yeah, one of those games that you just want to watch. You want to just, you know, rewind to the very start again at the full time whistle. But, you know, where did it come from is probably a question that's going to get asked a little bit, you would think, even over the coming days. And obviously, we have a week's break now as well before the next game. But, you know, Rory O'Connor points out in his piece in the Sunday Independent today, Paul O'Connell paced the pitch pre-game, staring at the ground as the non-playing scrum dominated the starters. So the warning signs were sort of there for everybody, including in the warm-up. What's your take on it, Brendan, coming from your background?
I thought the two teams, to me, played in the image of their head coach. If you ever look at Farrell being interviewed underneath, there's always that smile, and you just get the impression he's emotionally intelligent and he has a way of managing people. And I thought, if you listen to some of the interviews afterwards, you know, they were trying to probe, what did Farrell say during the week? And it was very much reassuring them, you know, everything we've done, we're top class, we're going well, no worry, no panic, forget about the outside noise. There was a picture in the Irish Times yesterday, I don't know if you saw it, a big smile on Tadhg Furlong, and it was like a team who played with no pressure, whereas Borthwick, stats man, systems man, play to the... And there was just no flair in the English team. They were just like a team who had no plan B at all. And I thought Farrell's team played with just that bit of flair and freedom. That was what it looked like to me. I mean, the Gibson Park try was just the epitome of that, wasn't it? Mm. Flair.
Definitely playing head. One of the big criticisms, but I was listening to Simon Zeebo on the rugby pod during the week, and he was talking about that absence of heads up rugby, and that was exactly it. And it wasn't just Gibson Park for that. Tadhg Byrne obviously was into the action as well to offload quickly. Your point about the Andy Farrell's reassurance about, like, we're very good players, we're a great group. So he'd been saying that to them for the last year, let's say, but it wasn't coming out on the pitch.
Yeah, well, look, obviously there's a little bit of a hangover him coming back from the Lions, and people underestimate that. That was a grueling test, you know, both in terms of time and intensity. And, you know, they're not robots. They can't just come back and fit into a November series after a long, long season. So, of course, people jump on a dip in form, and it's suddenly crisis and we're not going well, and... You know, it just took him time probably to get back on track with players. I thought he threw down a challenge after the French game, interestingly. Mm. You know,
absolutely.
he's got that seriousness as well. You know, the intent piece. Mm. Come on. And, you know, he dropped Gibson Park last week. And yet he had the courage to drop young Prendergast. You know, he realised, look, there's a humility in that. He went with, here's my man, I'm back in Prendergast. He puts him in for two games and he realised, you know what, maybe he's not ready. Maybe he needs a break. And I just thought that took courage. So you look at the way he handled the adversity of the last couple of weeks compared to Borthwick. So Borthwick comes in 12 games on the trot. They get turned over by Scotland and he just doesn't get his team ready. I mean, look at even the decisions he made in the match. George Ford makes two dreadful mistakes. I mean, at international rugby level, dreadful mistakes. And he takes Freddie Stewart off. I mean, you think to yourself, he brings Marcus Smith in at full back. Could he have brought Marcus Smith in at out half? Because he definitely made a change. Mm. So I thought he was very stoic. There's a great picture in the Times, actually, if you look at the two benches, you can see Sexton and Paul O'Connell, and they're all up out of their seats, fists pumping. And that's what I mean about the atmosphere. You just get the sense that there was a looseness or a freedom about Ireland yesterday, whereas it looked very stiff for England. No answers. System wasn't working. They'd no plan B. There were mistakes going. Actually, I looked at the ratings in the Sunday Times and I don't think any English player got above 5.
And the average
for Ireland is 8+.
You're right. There was a lot of 5s and then a couple of 4s and 1-3 for Pearl Freddie Stewart and Luke Condickey as well. It was one of those hold off.
I have a great line here that I sometimes, instead of reading the, you know, the actual match report, I love reading ex-players. So they give you a little bit of an insight. And Lawrence Dallaglio, I mean, he's just angry in the column. And it was unacceptable. Fans couldn't watch. You could have been forgiven for thinking that the fire alarm was going off in the second half because English supporters were heading for the exits in their droves.
Yeah. I saw a bit of that on TV and I thought, oh, it's just a trickle. But actually reading the reports today, they were in their droves. With 10 minutes to go as well, it was...
And imagine here in the fields of Athenry all through the first half, there wasn't a note of swing low.
It came out at one point after they got to within 15 points and I thought, that, you know, they must have thought, well, listen, we've something to hang on to here. We talk about the ratings for a minute. So... The looking across from Jameson Gibson Park goes 9.5 in the Sunday Times. The indoor dishing out 10s to McCluskey and Gibson Park as well. The 42 also go 10 for Gibson Park. And the miserly old Mail on Sunday, right? A few 9s for those two and Tadhg Byrne as well and Andy Farrell. But not a 10 to be seen, Orla McElroy. Yeah. Explain yourself.
Well, Shane McGrath is a hard taskmaster and he doesn't tend to give out 10s. I think, I don't know what you need to do to get a 10. I must ask him.
Harsh.
I'll come back.
Very harsh.
I'll let you know for sure.
Well, it is such a rarity to see it, but totally justified, you would feel, in the context of Gibson Park, McCluskey.
You could argue the McCluskey one, maybe. I don't know. I mean, McCluskey was superb. Gibson Park was just astonishing. And the one downside is that we've only won gems in Gibson Park, like, because he's just, when he's not there, there is a huge drop off. And when he's not on his A game, which he maybe hasn't been a couple of times at this level, like, that level is just unplayable. Like, he was outstanding. But to Brendan's point about what Farrell did, like, I think... The big thing we saw yesterday with Ireland was an identity that we haven't seen in a long time. And there was a sense that it was very much, they were worried about what they were doing. Not worried, but they were just concerned about what they were doing. And if they do what they do well enough, then they don't really need to worry about the opposition. Mm. Whereas in the past, you look at games where we played against France and you're worrying about allowing for DuPont, or you're playing South Africa and how do you counteract their power game? And you're worrying about things like that. But it always felt to me when Ireland were at their best in that 22-23 time that they just did what they did really, really well. And what they did was fight for each other and work damn hard. And to me, the thing that typified that yesterday was Stuart McCluskey. In the 74th minute, to race the way he did, and I didn't think he had that speed, but he absolutely galloped after Marcus Smith, who could clearly hear him coming because he absolutely bottled it and, you know, took the step back, and McCluskey was able to bundle him into touch. That's the one they will be hauling out when they meet again to say, this is what we expect and this is what we need and this is what an Irish rugby player has to produce. Mm-hmm. Because that is what I felt was missing. And there was a, like, right throughout the team, you could pick out people who led by what they were doing. This team doesn't have the Paul O'Connell type figure. You can't imagine them in the dressing room given the fear of God speech. But they have players who all across the pitch led by what they were doing, and they showed with their deeds the way to play. And I'm sure Andy Farrell would be thrilled with all of that he saw.
Yeah, the McCluskey thing was off the chart. There wasn't one person, including afterwards, listening to McCluskey himself in the interview, who thought he was going to catch Smith.
It was insane.
Like, he said, oh, I'm not going to get him. And then after a while, I thought, oof.
There's a famous saying, wing mirrors, when you can hear somebody coming. Yeah. It was like Marcus just looked in the wing mirrors or heard McCluskey coming, because you thought he had the speed to get across the line. I it's a real Paul O'Connell saying, no talent moments. No, yeah. You know, there's no talent required for that. That's just sheer hard work, guts, intent. Back to Farrell's thing. You know, I think I can imagine Paul O'Connell and Sexton before that England game. You're saying they're still in the dressing room.
Yeah.
And there's a piece in one of the papers about, I think it's Shane Horgan, you know, when you go to Twickenham as an Irish player, it does something for you. You know, it gets, and I think Farrell turned on that very well without creating the pressure. As you say, the pride in the jersey, the pride for each other, because that's what he spoke about afterwards.
Can I ask you then about that? So that's my worry now, right? And maybe, you know, when things calm down, and it's very early to be introducing worries to the conversation. So I do appreciate that. We're not trying to rain on anybody's parade here this morning. But that bit of, like, we could get up for England, we could get up because our backs were against the wall. Whether that, my point earlier about the sun, nice to see you, and you hanging around for a while. And it's that last bit that remains. And we won't know. We could have absolutely turned a corner here. We could have unearthed, as we have done, 5 or 6 or 7 new-ish players, I'll include McCluskey in that loosely, you know, who are here to hang around for the next year and a half. What's your sense of, like, looking at it and been around sport for a long time, Brendan, and the mentality of sport as to whether that was getting up for the occasion, bouncing back from average enough, certainly over the last couple of weeks and beyond, versus this is something that we can hang our hat on going forward?
Yeah, I think that's the test of a coach or a manager. You know, it's dealing with the different situations, dealing with defeats, and how you handle them and how you get back up again. Dealing now with favouritism, because they're going to be facing Scotland more than likely for a triple crown. A team, again, who probably have responded in the same way as Ireland. I mean, losing to Italy in the first match. I heard it said by some of the Scottish players, you know, we owe Gregor Townsend a performance. I think the Ireland team probably have the same relationship with Farrell. You know, we owe him a performance. So I'll be really interested in how the managers deal with both, because Scotland presumably will be coming in one game to go for a triple crown. Hopefully we'll be going for a triple crown as well. So we're looking at two managers now who are going to be dealing with expectations, and I probably think Farrell is best placed to deal with that. I think his man management skills are exceptional. So I think we're well placed for him to manage that type of expectation that's now going to come.
Yeah. What do you think, Orla? Is this?
You know who said a really interesting thing recently? I remember reading with Stuart Lancaster, right, who just is like a superb voice on this kind of thing. But he talked, I read an interview with him where he talked about when you come in somewhere, you don't want to raise the ceiling of the performance, you want to raise the floor. So you need a base level. And this is what Farrell can point back to and say, that's our floor. That's our floor. That's what we expect. That's the commitment level. And that's the performance that we expect Irish players to produce. And you can point that out now and say, there's the floor. The ceiling is up to you.
Well, if that's our floor, we're going to win the World Cup.
What? Don't go there again, please.
If that's the base, if we could get to that as our base.
But that's what you have to nominate as your base. This is what you expect. And it's, you look at players like, you know, there are players like a Josh van der Fleer, right, who is a 7 out of 10 player for me, right? More often than not, he will give you a 7 out of 10. Tadhg Byrne, similar effect with him. You will get a standard level of performance from them in every game where they're just brilliant. And their brilliance becomes almost routine. And you see that with Josh van der Fleer. He was World Player of the Year and quite unsung for that. But you want to get all the players to recognise that that is the level that you start at. You don't start from a 5 and work up. You start from that base level, and that base level is what they produced yesterday. And if you can get them to understand that, buy into that, and do it whatever way, like we always heard with Andy Farrell that he made brilliantly happy camps that players loved going into it. Like, I remember Peter O'Mahony talking about one of the Ireland camps and saying how it was the best team environment he'd ever been involved in. And for a statement like that from somebody like him, who's been around for so long, it says an awful lot about the environment that Farrell creates. And it's like you say, that environment will breed, you know, happy players, better performances. Mm. So they've talked about how the outside noise was never concerning them. They also will have been critical because, I mean, it's not just media who said it. Like, you can look at Shane Horgan, you can look at any number of ex-players, Bernard Jackman, they all point out that there have been performances below the base level and what would be expected and required by the team. And it's not by us, it's not by the media, it's not by the journalists and the people who are paying to go and see them. It's by the team themselves. You know for a fact they would not have been happy with some of those performances and they would expect better of themselves. And they've shown exactly what it is that they expect.
Simon Zeebo on that rugby pod I mentioned earlier said a couple of days ago, it's a weird old place in Ireland at the minute. People are out to get them a little bit. You can see there's a lot of pressure coming on. Like, there is, has been that sense, that bit of people are out to get them a little bit, which in the main has just been criticism, legitimate criticism of underperformance from a floor that we had become very accustomed to, have been much higher than it was.
Just before you leave, one of the, in the last probably couple of months, there were plenty of articles about the demise of Irish rugby and that we don't have the players coming through, that when we lose a Jonathan Sexton, it creates a huge hole, or we haven't got two players for every position. But I think yesterday showed Balakoon, Osborne at full back, obviously Stuart McCluskey, while he isn't young, he's no miles on the clock really because of injury. So we have found replacements in a lot of those. We had a front row that was devastated, and yet our scrum was probably that showed up against France and Italy to an extent,
To an extent yesterday would be one of the things that it's not as if it was a complete performance in that regard. Like, even looking at Orla was so generous as to share the player ratings from the Mail on Sunday London edition, and they weren't all that complimentary, it must be said, to Tadhg Furlong, 5 out of 10, and Jeremy Lachman, 5.5 out of 10. You know, like, reading the Irish papers, it's baseline 7 and then up from there. But there's a work on, I suppose, in the parlance of the day. Jack Crowley, we might just give a mention to, because obviously there's been so much. I've never seen so much conversation before a game or around a number of games about the importance of the out half, and so little conversation afterwards, almost, about the 10. It didn't feel like it was a, you know, like, he's given 8 out of 10, I think, in a lot of the papers today, and that feels like a reasonable rating. In a team where there were 3 or 4 9s out of 10 and maybe a couple of 10 out of 10s. Bernard Jackman in the Sunday Independent says, I have to say, Jack Crowley was also brilliant. He took his form from the bench to directing his team with a level of composure that was so impressive. And I think Rory O'Connor had made mention to it, something along the lines of, if I can find it here, a classy display, pulling strings and making good decisions while delivering from the tee. It wasn't perfect, but we can't expect perfection. A sense that it's his now, and I think Shane McGrath says in the Mail, his now and his for the next game or two, and we'll sort of see where we go from there.
Yeah, and like, Jack Crowley has produced this kind of performance in the past, and that's probably been why a number of people have kind of felt that maybe, you know, Sam Prendergast was promoted over him when they thought that Crowley had performed well in the 24 Six Nations and, you know, at times in the past. He's well capable of this type of performance, and he's a very reassuring 10, he looks like. And it certainly looks like there's a calmness and a relaxation of the team around him with the way he plays. And when he plays within the system and, you know, is not trying anything wild, but he's doing what Andy Farrell wants a 10 to do. Like, he is a great, okay, there was one messy kick, the other one missed by inches. He, if you want to be really picky, missed a couple of tackles, but he slowed down players. Like, you're not going to expect your 10 to tackle.
He was a Doris speed bump, and sometimes that's fine.
And yeah, and more effectively so probably than Prendergast had been. And look, let him have a go at it now. Maybe, and Andy Farrell's well capable of managing this better than anyone, maybe Sam Prendergast needs to go off and rebuild confidence with Leinster. Maybe it's no harm to start looking outside those two. You know, Kieran Frawley's going to Connacht next year as a 10. Do we need to see him at some point? Harry Byrne hasn't got a look in a 10.
Mm. I think I saw the picture of him in the...
He's right in front of the coaches. Right?
Yeah. With all the coaches and then Harry Byrne.
Yeah. And there's a couple of the players there with him. Mm-hmm. But like, he coming into the France game, he was the form 10.
There was a lot of chatter that he might get selected.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And but look, Jack Crowley turned in a superb performance. He's, as you say, probably a solid 8 out of 10 and maybe outshone by the fact that there were a number of 9s and if you want to give out 10s, there were so many outstanding performances. But he was rock solid and he was, you know, definitely things functioned very well around him.
If you're dealing with a player like Sam Prendergast now in the week or two ahead, Brendan, like Andy Farrell is well possibly sitting down with him at some point, even over the next few days, to say, with that team trucking the way it was, if you're on that pitch, you're driving that game just as well as anybody else. Obviously, the Orla's point about trying to rebuild that bit of confidence or whatever, but how would you take on a player like that?
Well, I think the first thing he would do, he would probably use the example of Crowley. You know, I mean, Crowley spent his period in the wilderness, if you like. You know, he's lost his place. Look at how he responded. That's what we would be expecting from you. You're young. You know, you go through that sport. You go through ups and downs. Now, here's the pathway back.
Yeah.
Here's what you need to do. And a good coach does that. You know, it's all very fine dealing with people who are in form. You don't have a lot to do with them. It's your challenge with coaching comes when people are out of form. How do you get them back? How do you rebuild their confidence? And there's enough people around. Look, he has Jonathan Sexton there, somebody who knows all about being number one and being number two. So, there's great people around to build his confidence back up again.
I wonder what that path back is. At some point, he is going to have to get back on the pitch.
Probably with Leinster, you know, but then again, he has the challenge of Harry Byrne. Isn't it interesting I think it was Matt Williams a number of weeks ago was talking about this demise, about how Leinster were producing the vast majority of players, but yet there was nowhere for some of them to go. They were backed up, you know, they were coming into the Leinster Academy, they were backed up. It's a bit like teams who are on a winning streak and you can't get into the team and yet you're really talented. And I think it's time that we did send the Frawleys or the Harry Burns or people like that to Connacht and to Ulster, because we have the four clubs and we need to use them much better. And so that's what I think needs to happen. It's a bit like, you know, at international level or even at county level, releasing players back to a lower level to build their confidence up again. And I think that's what Sam probably needs to do.
You certainly see the benefit of it with Harry Byrne. Like, Harry Byrne took the decision to go after it was in Bristol. And like, how that's benefited him. And maybe that, you know, it's been mentioned by a few people, maybe the IRFU do need to look at the possibility of freeing up some people to go and do similar and not have them frozen out of the Ireland situation if they choose to do so, because it's certainly stood to Harry Byrne.
Yeah, and loosening up that rule that, you know, if you're playing, I mean, England's across the water. Exactly. What's the difference of coming to a camp if you're flying in from Bristol or flying up from Cork? You know, there's no difference.
Well, I think they want to manage their own players, manage minutes, manage contracts. Like, by and large, it hasn't worked out too badly for us. I mean, I understand the counterpoint to even saying that. There'll be, I'm sure, people texting in with the words World Cup. Andy Farrell, by the way, and it wasn't lost to me in the middle of commentary, I'm sure people picked up on it, and he addresses it in his piece today as well, Bernard Jackman. Andy Farrell, in reports from Midi Olympique in France, that he's agreed to take over at Saracens after the 2027 World Cup. Mark McCall is going upstairs, as they say, some sort of administrative role at the end of this season. Farrell, obviously been head coach here since after the 2019 World Cup. He's been in the country for a decade. Bernard Jackman says, I don't know if Farrell has signed for his former club, but if he hasn't, I sincerely hope that David Humphreys is able to tie him down to a new contract. So this is the thing. I'm sure it's going to get... I don't think it got brought up in the aftermath yesterday. Probably not the time for it, to be fair. But it'll come up over the next few days. Interesting.
Well, I'm sure. It's interesting, like, you know, Bernard saying... And Bernard is incredibly well-sourced. Like, if people are texting him about this, then there's... You do wonder, is it like, you know, often at this time of year we hear of players taking trips over to England to talk to certain clubs because their contracts are up for renewal. Is there an element of that to it? David Humphreys was sitting in that box yesterday in front of Andy Farrell. So I'm sure he has regular and ongoing chats with him about this kind of thing. I don't imagine he's the kind of player that are kind of person and coach that the IRFU are going to want to lose. I don't know what respect, like if he, you know, do you continue, do you sign him up now and say, we're giving you a contract for beyond the 27 World Cup? Like, is it a bit
yes.
great to do that?
I mean, listen, we're all for a bit of recency.
Was that after the France game?
No, exactly.
Yeah, so it's a very difficult one. Like, and you know, the FAI have been slated for this in the past of giving out contracts too far out from a tournament and then things go south. Not suggesting for a second that it will, but it's very hard to predict the future. And I mean, you can read, you know, as we were all the 2020 hindsight, like none of us were predicting, very few of us were predicting this sort of a result 2 days ago.
No.
So it's how quickly things can change. You do have to wonder, you know, whether that'll influence the thinking. But yeah, it'd certainly be an interesting move if he was going to coach in the Saracens.
It would be a huge distraction. I mean, you see it so often where managers, you know, tell their players or tell the organisation, you know, this is my last season. And yeah. it invariably doesn't work out. Mm. It's a distraction. I mean, as I said at the outset, even Farrell being away on the Lions, Ireland dipped. Mm. You know, there's when you have a distraction like that, it definitely affects. You think it doesn't. But
why is that?
Again, I think there's just that element of the group breaking up. It's very few people get a swan song where it all works out nice and neat, you know. It's the distraction, you know.
Players
is the only way.
To the future.
Yeah, and he's leaving, or you know, the sense of the band breaking up. Mm. It's like the lead singer leaves the band; it's not the same again.
Yeah.
Or you know, there's uncertainty as to who the replacement will be. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that grows legs, that story.
Would you have ever headed into any of your inter-county jobs with a view of this is the last, I'm going to give it one last go with this group and I'm gone? And would you have kept that to yourself, or would people have known around you?
I'd certainly say in Ballymun, I was 5 years there. We won a championship in 20 and there was no Leinster, because of COVID, there was no Leinster or All-Ireland. And then you think, okay, in the following year, you know, we really will give that Leinster a crack, and it doesn't work out. And then you think, keep the band together. It's very difficult for a man. You know, you hear those stories from time to time about being, and it happened to Farrell, too loyal to older players who fought with you. So you know in your heart and soul. Well, that's the other thing with Farrell. You know, your voice is there for 5 years or 7 years. I think change is necessary for a group as well. You know, you can hear the same voice and the same patterns week in, week out, and you can see a change sometimes is what a team needs.
Mm. Is the manager often the last person to spot that?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. As I said, you stay loyal to your warriors. You're doing your best to bring people in, but you're under pressure to win. And so I can see, look, it's happened to the great teams. I see a picture on the wall behind of the great Kerry team. You know, when you're winning, very hard to bring in new players. Dublin, mind you, Dublin did it quite well. But there comes a time, you know, when you know I can't give any more. I've said everything that I have to say to this group. I've yeah. done everything with them. And I think we'll come to a piece later on about Kilkenny are now beginning to look for outside voices to
freshen it up a bit.
Things
well,
like,
even
yeah.
Kieran McGeaney, like, geez, you'd have to remind yourself about how long he's been in Armagh, because it feels he's so fresh in terms of his approach and what he says, and he's very challenging and he's a bit spiky and he's charismatic, but I've no sense of him being there. Is it 10 years, whatever he's been at yeah. Armagh? It feels like, obviously, the body of evidence is there and we all know the reality, but it does feel like it's only really a couple of years old. It's a real achievement, isn't it?
He keeps it fresh too, yeah. you know, and in fairness to Farrell, you know, before we leave the rugby, he's kept it fresh. Mm. You know, I mean, Jonathan Sexton was not coming back into rugby yeah. as he was retiring. But, you know, within a year, you had him back in again, and Paul O'Connell. So he's kept it fresh. Even the long managers, again, when we look at Leo Cullen in Leinster, trying to keep it fresh. How long is Leo must be there 10 years, is he?
Yeah, he would
yeah.
be. Yeah.
But you need those voices, don't you? And that's like, you know, as we were talking about Sexton and O'Connell, like Clive Woodward highlights that about how smart it is of Farrell to use those, because him and Easterby as well have both been there for a very long time. Like Farrell was under Joe Schmidt before he took over.
Yes.
So it's been the same voice for some of the players. Now, you do have newer players coming in, and to them, it's all new and it's fresh. And, you know, Rob Balakoon, Stuart McCluskey, Jamie Osborne, they're not players who've been exposed to him for 6, 8 years, anything like that. So, yeah, you know, there is a freshness in terms of how it works for them. And clearly, like, he's still able to motivate players like Jamison Gibson-Park. Like, there was discussion yesterday on the commentary, wasn't there, about how Gibson-Park had taken last week and kind of gone to the management and said, what is it that you want from me? What do I need to do? What do I need to do better, look?
Yeah. Insane, isn't it?
Absolutely. But it
just replay the tape from yesterday from now on.
Yeah,
just
do that.
Yeah. It was funny because it struck me that last week, and I should be able to remember the author, but I can't. Somebody had written a piece about, you know, there's too many inside voices in that Irish backroom staff. There's not enough, you know. Andy Farrell came in because, you know, obviously the England thing had gone belly up and they decided that they needed new, fresh, challenging voices at that time. And I think it had been a mix of Schmidt and some of the players saying, get him in because he'll challenge everything. Whereas what Andy Farrell has done is stacked up with Irish people. And you mentioned Clive Woodward's piece. He says, Farrell's use of Sexton and O'Connell is very, very canny. They're essentially the Johnny Wilkinson and Martin Johnson of Irish rugby. I'd love England to make use of their ex-professionals like Ireland did. So it's funny how in a week it's gone from, and listen, I'm sure Clive Woodward maybe had that view already, but like that bit of, maybe we should be looking from the outside. Now suddenly it's this. Everything looks rosy now, right across the board.
That's it. I mean, like a few weeks ago, to be fair, there was a number of us, and I'll include myself, who were saying that maybe the Lions thing wasn't a great, you know, him going off on the Lions wasn't a great idea. Maybe the fact that he didn't challenge himself with outside voices on that, right? Mm-hmm. So on the Lions, he could have picked coaches from Scotland, England, Wales, brought them with him, but he brought a number of the coaches with whom he's familiar, and he, you know, brought Johnny Sexton ahead of people who have been in the game in coaching longer. So, you know, we would be remiss of us not to mention that we were criticizing him for some of the things that we're now saying been a good idea, you know. So,
and he's resisted the temptation to go, told you so.
Fair play to him. He's a bigger man than some people.
Yeah. The you mentioned earlier, Brendan, just that some of the photographs, like from the coach's box, like there's one there for anybody who's watching on YouTube, you'd be familiar, haven't seen the game yesterday, but like it's Paul O'Connell with his arm in the air. Farrell is punching the air. They're all, Finney Hammond is punching. They're all at it. Like, you know, there's full bore and they, to all intents and purposes, seem to have lost the run of themselves, which is 100%. We're all here for it. But there is a lot now, isn't there, of that, like, you know, how are you, somebody monitoring what the coach's body language, I'd say in the coach's box, and how are you doing on the sideline? What's your body language like when all this is going off? So what was your view of watching that yesterday? The losing the run of yourself, is that right every now and then? Or
look, you have to
keep
it
checking it, lads.
You have to bring a bit of emotion in. I just hate watching these stoic coaches who stand on the line as if, you know, they're just watching any old game. I mean, I think you just need that bit of emotion. And he clearly shows that, you know, that's what I said about, you get that mix with Farrell of steeliness, and you just see this wry smile at times and you think, yeah, there's an emotional intelligence about that guy that I really admire. You know, maybe Joe was a bit stoic, so we needed, after Joe Schmidt, we needed an Andy Farrell. The only other player around at the moment, and it'll be fascinating to see, I have great time for Finn Russell. He's one of the few players who's just playing with a smile. I mean, he kicked a ball yesterday, the kickoff yesterday against Wales, and he just turns around and he grins at everybody and goes, told you so.
Fulham is strolling back. There's a lot of people have seen it, but Wales get a penalty. Scotland has the kickoff. Russell spots that Fulham has got his back to him and is retreating back into his 22, so just kicks it over his head. And the onrushing Scotland wing nips in and genius.
Yeah.
And he's playing his best rugby, Finn Russell, isn't he? You know.
Yeah, I mean, look at it. I suppose we're so used to hearing the process and systems, and you know, soccer has become so boring, really, with players just not able to express themselves. I mean, I remember for years that, you know, I liked Wenger for the fact that he brought something different, but then it came to the stage where you're going, would you just cross a ball into the box? You know, it was like, no, get to the edge of the box, back out again, go to the other edge, and you're thinking systems, probably football, Gaelic got the same, you know, playing the system, and flair went out of it. Yeah. I mean, I was in Croke Park last night and you just could not buy like David Clifford.
Yeah.
He kicked a two-pointer last night and you're thinking, just wow, he's worth the entrance fee alone to see Flair. You know, and that's what I liked about Farrelly. He was celebrating Flair. You know, wouldn't it be worse if he sat there stoically going, oh, you know, I told you so. Yeah. And the two boys sitting around beside him. I mean, I'd say Paul O'Connell nearly lifted the seat out of it.
There was times where there was like, you know, something would happen. O'Connell was sort of sitting there with nothing, you know, he wasn't doing very much. But then there was other times, like in that photograph, the sight of Paul O'Connell in full celebration. There's something the nation needs to get celebrate about that. It's
there was a brilliant shot of Farrell at one point where he was doing the wild, you know, fist pump and celebration, then realised he was on camera and kind of told him.
That might have been the McCluskey trackback. He seemed to enjoy that more than almost anything else that happened in the game yesterday. I have a note here to get into some of the England doom and gloom. Will we just bypass that and keep motoring elsewhere? Lawrence Dallaglio particularly, and you know, they're trying to figure their way through stuff in a way that I know that we'd not too long ago that we were in the same boat.
Yeah, because isn't it amazing? Like heading into this championship, you were thinking like, you know, France and then England and then probably Ireland, you know, say what you will about Scotland, you could place them in a number of positions. But you were definitely thinking England were ahead of us and they had this clear mentality and identity and they knew what they were doing and they were, you know, going after the contestables. But like somebody actually, they were doing that, right? That's fine. We weren't specifically doing that in the France game. There was a bit of, what are we doing? You know, there was a lot of those kicks that weren't winning back. I think it's Shane Horgan who points out, like, you could not have predicted the level to which Ireland improved at so many things for that game yesterday. And that was one of those. Like, the, you know, how did they suddenly learn to grab those balls in the air?
Oh, Tommy O'Brien was like dominating everything, Jamie Osborne.
Corner, yeah. And the level at which that changed. So is that, you know, is it the small margins that they've been telling us that, because a lot of things were going right for Ireland yesterday as well. They were getting bounce of the ball and things were going right for them. And they haven't had that kind of look for a little while. But, you know, England, from having had a very clear identity and a very clear path, and you were looking at them going, oh yeah, they know what they're doing. Now all of a sudden you're going, well, 18 months of the World Cup, are they going to have to rip that up and start again? Because that's certainly what a lot of the English view position is, that this hasn't worked.
Well, is that not a case of, you know, again, what had they won, 12 on the bounce, system, and suddenly the system is challenged and players don't have a plan B or don't have the... They just don't have the intelligence, if the game intelligence to read what's happened and go to a plan B. You know, that's what struck me about England yesterday. It was just like the system broke down. A few key people in it, like Ford, for example, you know, it breaks down and all of a sudden they're floundering.
Floundering. Well, even you mentioned earlier, Fred Stewart coming off for the sin bin and he's back in the pitch. He's no sooner on the pitch than he's been brought off to be substituted. That felt like a weird one to me. Why would you not have just left him off and
make a minute to half time
and make the sub right there? Like, I understood Marcus Smith coming in, even if you just get one play before half time, but just do it while you're still in the sin bin, like, or at the end of the sin bin. English pundits after the Scotland game were like, this is brilliant, this is the best thing that could have happened, you know, we needed this, you know, in terms of World Cup preparation. The narrative has shifted now in a fairly significant way. Anyway, listen, we said we're not going down that path. Orly, you tried to drag us down there, but we'll resist.
We'll stick with the,
Do keep the comments coming into us. We're here with Orly McIlroy and Brendan Hackett, and we're getting stuck into the Sunday back pages. And the Sunday Paper Review and Off the Ball is in partnership with Centra. Make sure your fridge is match ready to kick off with a cold one. Over 18s only, and drink responsibly. Get the facts. Visit drinkaware.ie. Right, the papers today are jam-packed with the goodness of the game yesterday, so there's plenty to enjoy about that. There's some funny writing elsewhere and good writing elsewhere and deep and tragic and challenging writing elsewhere, and we will get to that in a little bit. But maybe for the smartest writing of the day, and I feel like I'm saying this on a weekly basis now, but we go to Conor McKeown, hold the back page at the Sunday Independent. We're easily pleased, and photograph of the man we mentioned earlier on, Kieran McGinney, hands in the pocket, prowling the sideline. And this is a piece about the word piggery, and it's created consternation up and down the country since it was first uttered last weekend. Kieran McGinney's unhappiness levels with the situation, particularly around the kickout and the mayhem and piggery that it's causing in midfield, particularly. Conor McKeown here says, the sensation of watching Gaelic football now is like descending Cairn Toohill in a three-wheeled shopping trolley. Before, it felt vaguely soporific, a 70-minute game of Tetris stuck on level one. And I suppose the point being that it's not that now. Brendan, you were at the game last night. It wasn't possibly the greatest advertisement for the new rules, but generally, that notwithstanding.
Yeah, look at that. I think Kieran has always been somebody who, as a defender himself, as a player, he just loved the whole defensive side of the game. You know, and as Conor says in his piece, you know, an Armagh victory that was engineered on defensive ingenuity, really. And so he's kind of bemoaning this whole idea of, you know, why did we need to change the game? And
because it was awful.
Oh, we know that. But, you know, as
people seem to like it, is the phrase that he keeps using, which I absolutely love every time he says it.
I know, but having been involved a little bit up in Ulster football, you know, yeah, they loved their defensive shape and 15 behind the ball. And, you know, it didn't matter that it was a drab fest. It was, you know, it was who could defend better. And they'd have been very happy with a 4-3 game.
Yeah.
I mean... Publicly, I think everybody has realised that the game is much better now. It did need a change, and it is much better. And the forwards now, look, there's two, you know, Kieran can bemoan defence, but really there's a challenge now for defenders to defend again. Mm. You know, if you're one-on-one with a David Clifford, or you're on one-on-one with a Sean O'Shea or a Conor O'Callaghan, that's going to bring the best out in defenders. And there's a whole generation of players who've grown up not knowing how to tackle because they had a safety in numbers with 15. You could pass somebody on. But now we're back to good old style defenders having to, you know. So Kieran bemoaning the piggery at the kick out, I think, as Conor alludes to, what is he saying here? All ball contact games, or all contact ball sports, contain elements of piggery. And he said somewhere a bit about...
Rugby, know, was it?
No, your average Premier League ground 6-yard box during corner kicks resembles a feral hog pen. You know, look, that's the nature of contact sport. There's always going to be a bit.
The midfield, why does the midfield have to be piggery, is the question that I have. Like, are you not slightly in control of it from your own kick out in a way to manipulate the pitch to create less piggery?
Yeah, I mean, it's been there long before the short kick out. I mean, as we know, Stephen Cluxton just changed the landscape with short kick outs. I mean, the whole game for 100 years was based on contests in the middle of the field, and people, you know, were lauded for those. Your Mick O'Connells, your Jim McKeever from Derry, your Brian Mullins, your Shawnee Walsh's, you know, that has been lauded for years. And I think they felt that with the short kick out, that element of the game was gone. And there was a, you know, like, look, let's bring it back. So probably it's for people who've grown up with a sanitised version of midfield. In other words, there was no midfield kick out really. And now suddenly we're back to a different game. And there's players who didn't grow up. I mean, I'm the last of a generation where when you went up to the field, it was half the team in the goals and half the team out in midfield. And there were only one ball at training. And if you couldn't survive in a contest, you just didn't get a kick of a ball. You might have been there for an hour, and that just disappeared completely out of the game. So those, as I said, for the last maybe 10 plus years, we've been looking at possession games with very little contest in midfield. So now suddenly we're back to a man-on-man contest and reading the play. There's a skill to that. There's reading breaks. And as you say, you can set up your kickouts, you can split your midfielders, you can open out space, you can create pockets, but that's going to take them a year or two to figure that out.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know why Kieran would bemoan that for a man who loves physical contests himself.
I won't go into the full details of it, but Joe Brawley certainly feels that Kieran isn't all about it because it might not necessarily help his teams win in All-Ireland, which is maybe fair enough as well. But Joe is very much one of those people who seem to like it. He says in his piece a few pages prior, to keep the ball endlessly, hand passing it back and forth and over the head of the outnumbered attacker, piggery in the middle, he calls it, which is a nice little phrase that he's coined at first. He says, now the game's electrified, it's rocking. The senior club final was the best I've ever seen, week in, week out. We're amazed by the comebacks, the skills, the high fetching, the goals, and of course the kickouts. But it's just not the case for Kieran McGeady. I think he's, I mean, I'm not saying he's a lone voice entirely in it. Conor McKeown says that the way he sees it, McGeady, if scores are harder to get, are they not by definition better? Should we not therefore value and appreciate them more? It's a fair point, says Conor McKeown. It's a pity McGeady is so wrapped up in all the business of pursuing excellence because he'd make an exceptional pundit, which is also a good side point. But I do take that bit. McGeady's view is scores are hard to get, no matter how they come about, then by definition they're better. But I think generally people's definition of better is more to do with how pleasant they are to look at. Which undoubtedly they are at the minute.
Which is, you know, you'll go for a David Clifford two-pointer rather than a ball that's been endlessly worked around before somebody finally fists the ball over the bar. Like, give me the Clifford two-pointer any day. But one point McGeady has been consistently raising, and he's right about, we've turned into basketball, McGeady winced after Armagh's breathless draw with Galway. And the stats bear him out in that hand passes are up under the new rules. So he's not wrong in that respect, in that it does kind of resemble that play around the, you know, the 3-point line on a basketball court where players are just passing around until somebody gets the opportunity to shoot. So he does have a point in that hand passes are up, that's happening more, but then the hand passes being up are leading to the opportunity for somebody to, you know, have a go at a 2-pointer or make a break up, you know, for a goal or whatever it is. So, like, there's going to be bits you're not going to like. Are they worth it for the greater good? Yeah, I think they definitely are.
Definitely. How good was McGeady last night? Were you watching him when the ball wasn't around him? Movement, all that sort of... Clifford.
Yeah, he just has that languid style, doesn't he? I mean, he has a game appreciation to realise, you know, I can create space for other people here. And if he takes defenders out of the way like he did in the All-Ireland last year, I mean, you'd love to have had a camera on him. A number of months ago, I was at a programme, I don't know if you'd heard about it, they put a camera on George Best back in the 70s, a German film crew, and they showed it in the National Concert Hall a while ago, and it was just a full hour and a half with four cameras on George Best. And the amount of time he spent walking around, he scored one goal and they won the game 1-0. But for all the little dummy runs, the little shuffles, and you're thinking to yourself, he worked so hard. But yet I'd say he only touched the ball 10 times in that hour and a half. And it's a bit like that with Clifford. He's constantly walking, thinking, sizing the game up, creating space for others. He's handled everything. He handles abuse. He handles physical contact and pulling and fellas in his face. And yet,
double marking, triple marking.
He's a real team player. He's individually brilliant. But people underestimate his team skills.
His ability to direct teammates around him as well is, you don't see it in camera, but an incredible thing to watch.
Yeah, phenomenal. And he'll draw defenders. He knows he's got that aura to draw a couple of people to one side and create space. I think the underestimate in the Kerry setup is Sean O'Shea. I watch him again off the ball. I'd love to see his GPS. I'd say he's close to 15 kilometres in the game because he is back and up and back, and he's the one who makes total use of Clifford's ability to create space for him.
We had Seamus Flanagan on during the week, and he was talking about asking the Limerick video analyst to get some footage of Clifford to show him what runs could be made, so that Seamus Flanagan might be able to bring some of this to the Limerick hurlers, which is an incredible thing. What would you do if you're setting up a team against him, Clifford?
Oh, don't talk to me. I had that experience as a minor manager.
Had you?
An All-Ireland semi-final.
Kildare?
Kildare, yeah, against Clifford. And of course, they won it well. I mean, that was a phenomenal minor teams in those years with Sean O'Shea and Clifford. But, you know, it was at the time somebody asked me afterwards, you know, would you not have double teamed him or had two sweepers?
What did you do?
I just played the game as we played. We went to win it. But they were just better. But then in the All-Ireland final a couple of weeks later, he scores 4-4 against Derry, and I'm thinking, oh right, nobody remembers the semi-final, but everybody remembers that final.
That's small mercy.
Look,
in fairness, he was like a man playing physically at that point. Yes.
The only team I've seen that really handled it was the Dublin victory in the All-Ireland a couple of years ago, where everybody spoke about Mick Fitzsimons, but the real damage was done out the field. You know, they just cut that supply off. I mean, you look at Paddy all the time. He just has this radar vision as to where David is. Mm. Even last night when he came on at half time, you know, he just has that sense where David is. But that, I think it's out the field you have to cut off the supply or make it as difficult for David to get clean ball as possible. You know, putting two men in front of him is only going to create havoc for somebody else like Sean O'Shea or the Gainies to make hay with. Yeah. And he'd love that. You know, Clifford would happily take two and three men out of it to let others score. That's the beauty about him.
It wasn't just the Kerry team that were full of stars. Was Paul Mescal playing? Was that before that, or was he?
It was just before us. Yeah, yeah. Actually, Paul Mark Conn O'Callaghan in a Leinster final.
How did that go?
He'd won a Leinster final the year before as a cornerback, and then he was captain that year. Ah, look, Conn was a phenomenal player, like David Clifford when he was a minor. That forward line had Colin Baskell and Conn. Yeah, he had his hands full. I still say he would have made it. He would have been
would
on
he?
The current. Oh, no doubt about it.
He'd good been footballer. On, he'd what was his, what were his main attributes as a footballer?
Intelligence. You know, that intelligence that some people have innately about being able to read a game. It's always uncanny how players can play 2 and 6. Good cornerbacks sometimes make great centre backs. And likewise, it's their ability to read a game. I always love that old Franz Beckenbauer statement from way back before your time. You know, people used to say, Franz, you know, you're not the quickest. And he said, well, if you line me up with the best centre forwards in the world and we run from A to B, they'll all beat me. But in a game, I don't start from A.
Yeah, very good.
You know, and that game intelligence is what some of the great centre-backs had.
You know, that clip is going to go up now with Paul Mescal. Paul Mescal is the Franz Beckenbauer of Gaelic
I didn't
football.
Say, I just said you that game intelligence.
I'm joking. So I presume you're hitting him up for tickets, or he is, that like, you know, get me the Premier.
No, I've seen him, I've paid my way. I've seen him in London a couple of times.
That's lovely.
And even
he's a great story.
I remember at the time you'd ask all the guys what do they want to do in their leaving cert? Because most of them, you know, coming up to in that minor year. And he was very clear, you know, he wanted to go to Lear. And I'd asked him about Lear, you know, it was connected to Trinity. And there were only about 16 places.
Actors Academy, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, he was really keen on that. But very, very bright. Phenomenal family, I have to say.
Musicians.
Really appreciate. I was at the launch of his mother's book the other night. And a fantastic woman. But, you know, as they say, he didn't lick it off the ground. You know, in that way, like, she is a very determined, you know. And when he decided that he wanted to go, full backing. And when he got into Lear, it was, you know, you need to move into town. You need to be there. And his first breakthrough was, and he grabbed it with both hands. But, you know, probably aside, and I relate it to sport, I just think sometimes sports people moan a bit, and I look at actors who, when they go on to the West End and they have to do 8 shows a week, 6 nights and 2 matinees. I mean, I went to see Paul in A Streetcar Named Desire, which is a very vigorous play. It was a matinee. I went in afterwards and he had injured himself during one of the physical scenes, but, you know, 2 hours, he had to go back out again, new crowd, they'd all paid their money. And it doesn't matter how you're feeling, you know, sometimes. And there's a physicality in it, and there's a mental piece in it. You know, because it's interesting, in the rugby, there was a kind of complaints this year that it was 3 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
I know it's a very physical. But I think players like games coming thick and fast, because there certainly was a couple of years there where people weren't, they were training 3 times a week and games were not coming. Yeah. And fast. We look at some of the championship, those long breaks between first rounds and semi-finals. So, yeah, there's a lesson there. I think players are well conditioned now to play more regularly.
Very good. We have a pair of the shorts there knocking around somewhere, signed pair of famous shorts there.
Talented musician too.
Yeah, like, and his sister.
Singer and his sister Nell as well. Like, they're some family.
The last time I, as I said, when I saw him, there was a guitar in the corner. I said, this was early last year, and I said, "Don't tell me you learned to play the guitar now." And he goes, "Yeah, I'm playing it left-handed for a role that's up and coming." I didn't pass any remarks, and then a couple of months later, it's announced he's playing Paul McCartney. So it just shows you. I mean, he was working for that months out. That's
he could have been playing for the Clare Footballers. This is the biggest problem.
I thought you were going to say the biggest shame, Marla.
Yeah, it is the biggest shame. Clare could do them.
Right, we will move on from that segue to just another GAA piece here in the Sunday Times. Christy O'Connor, is it still the Kilkenny way with help from the outside? Counties recruited non-native coaches for the first time as they seek to transform their fortunes. So this is Life Under Derek Ling at Kilkenny, and we thought, particularly Brendan, with yourself, have managed non-native counties to get your view on it. Christy talks about Mick O'Flynn from Cork and Leash's Michael Dempsey have been long-term contributors to the Kilkenny cause over the years, but they'd lived in Kilkenny, so they weren't necessarily seen. Geez, I think most people would tell you that Michael Dempsey was probably a Kilkenny man more so than he was maybe Leash. But anyway,
don't forget, Michael managed the Leash footballers. So when went into Kilkenny, he was very much a football manager.
Right.
He wasn't hurling.
So there'd have been a degree of controversy almost. Or
The piece is talking about, you know, Kilkenny maybe a feeling a little left behind, and they've turned to some outsiders. You know, their traditional style is in need of reinvigoration. So they've gone for, you know, outside people.
Niall Corker, and former Dublin player, he's from Galway initially, has worked with a couple of other countries, including Leash, where he worked with Eddie Brennan, who's now involved there as well. Timmy Hoolan had worked with Limerick for 6 years, brought in as a goalkeeping coach. And as Christy writes, it's been important to make Kilkenny more tactically streetwise now, he says in a single word sentence afterwards, by way of commentary.
And there's nothing new in that. I mean, we look at the traditional approach from Kerry. They took in Paddy Talley a couple of years ago. Jack O'Connor realised if this is the way the game is going, I need one of these northern coaches. It's rampant in sport, but it's rampant in the GAA. Kieran McGeaney, who we spoke about, bringing up Paul... or Donaghy.
Kieran Donaghy.
Keane O'Neill, of course.
Paul McGrain. You know, now you have a situation where ex-managers are going in. So there's a number of ex-managers. So it's quite common. I suppose when a traditional county bring in somebody from outside, it makes headlines. But I would contend that Brian Cody did that before.
Yeah.
You know.
What was your sense of going into counties that weren't your own native county, let's say, in terms of trying to create that? So the perceived wisdom here, and I think it's not necessarily correct, but you know, you need somebody. Tell me the last county to win the All-Ireland with a manager who didn't come from that county. So the perception being that like success is only winning an All-Ireland final. But your sense of going into counties that weren't your own and working with players and...
Yeah, I think the traditional counties are fortunate in some ways in that they have the tradition and they have usually ex-players lining up to take the job. So it's very unusual for your Kerrys, your Dublins, Kilkennys to go for outside. And they've had success with their internal manager. So they don't need to go outside for a manager. They may bring in the outside expertise behind the scenes. As you say, it's you'd have to go back a long way to find a county who won in All-Ireland with an outside manager. My guess is Offaly.
Yeah.
Going back to Dermot Healy and Eugene McGee.
Yeah.
I can't think of too many.
Is it not a ridiculous benchmark? Like, I mean,
it's the weaker counties that look for outside expertise. Usually they're looking for, you know, maybe it's a sign of we don't have winners within our own county and we're trying to bring in, you know, people from other counties who've had experience of success, or maybe they have some kind of sports science background. We're looking for the edge. But I personally, from having been an outsider, I would have to recommend that it's internal.
Really?
No, yeah. I never brought a clatter of people with me. I really think that...
You relied on people locally.
Yeah, but I think counties should strive to develop their own coaches and their own managerial people. You know, spot them early on, ask them, set them on a trail. Even if they have to go to another county for a while to work in a backroom team, but come back to your own county. It's very hard to just get that sense of internally what makes a county tick.
We'd a Kildare player on with us recently talking about, he was in there, I will think of his name in a second, David Hyland, and he was talking about McGeaney's early days. I think he was there for a year at that first time when McGeaney went in, and he talked about like Kieran McGeaney trying to understand what it was to be a Kildare person and get that across them. Like, it is doable for an outside manager to be there, but your sense is not that.
No, I honestly think the county should be endeavouring to develop their own.
Is that part of your remit, your GA remit?
Coach development. Really. Coach education, coach development, the talent academies. One of the stats that struck me, and it was phenomenal, we had all the leaders of the talent academies from the 32 counties in December. There's 10,000 plus young players in talent academies in the GAA. And there's about 1,000 coaches working in those talent academies. So I would see that's a big, you know, resource those coaches, develop them so that they're confident to take over minor teams, then confident to take on under 20 teams. I really think that's the way to go.
What's a talent academy? Is that a...
Well, it used to be called development squads, under 14, 15, 16, those development squads where you're bringing in the best young players from clubs.
Yeah, which is a huge number. Can we mention, there's a few pieces that we want to mention. One of them is in the Sunday Times, and I mentioned about the some of the writing in the breadth of it today. This is David Walsh. A violent storm, death in a forest, and a four-year wait for answers, writes David Walsh. Owen McCarthy's car went off a bridge during an Irish rally in 2022. The parents of the 22-year-old still have questions about what happened on the day and the year since, and it's a really brilliant, long piece of writing in the Sunday Times today. It's a tragic story. It's exceptionally well told by David Walsh. It's sensitive and it's detailed and it's awful. And from the confusion about whether the race should have gone ahead, post-storm impact on the roads, the dangers of it, the holes, the craters it was creating in the roads, the accident that took the life of Owen McCarthy, the confusion about whether it was him or someone else by the same name around the time that it unfolded, the delay in confirming that, the wrong location of the ambulance to connect with the air ambulance, 2 hours, 48 minutes between the accident and Owen arriving at the hospital, and writes David Walsh here, at 9:52pm, almost 5 hours after arriving at the hospital in Cork, Owen McCarthy was pronounced dead. His dad can't blame the sport for Owen's death. He remains a rally enthusiast. Conor continues to compete. He's his brother. But Liam and Nora were left with many unanswered questions. It's a hell of a read, Orla.
It is, and it's like, as you say, David tells it very well. He just allows the story to unfold and the story speaks for itself. But what struck me was like the tragedy of two parents who've been left with so many unanswered questions, and it, like, about the day, about the safety, about what happened in the aftermath, about the support they were given by the governing body in the aftermath, about, there's just so many questions they're left with. And like, one really sad thing is from his mother says, at the time we didn't know if it was a bang to the head or if Owen drowned. And 2.5 years would pass before we saw the post-mortem report. Like, I can't imagine how a parent continues breathing through those 2.5 years, not knowing how their son died. Like, it's desperately, desperately sad. And they've had to, you know, engage a solicitor and they're trying to find out what's going on. The coroner's inquest has yet to take place. And they're hoping it'll take place in spring or early summer of this year. It's just a desperately tragic story, and your heart would just go out to those parents.
But the delay is just adding insult to further insult, and why drag this out for them when it's such an awful, clearly an awful thing to have gone through.
It's very reminiscent of a piece that David has written about the young Scottish rugby player. I can't remember her name. Female rugby player
Similar. Siobhan Cadogan.
Yeah, similar circumstances. Parents couldn't get answers.
Yeah.
I think David just, he's written a couple of those pieces, and he's probably our finest, I think, when it comes to getting really under the skin of a story. And if he finds a story like that, you'll see more about that. He won't just write that and leave it. You know, what I like about David is he's a dog on a bone when he has a story, and he will follow and he'll push and he will ask the questions. And there's still, from a journalistic point of view, I still think there's a great read in reading it. You know, everybody talks about people want bite-sized pieces. There's still great reading in a David Walsh piece.
Absolutely.
Or a Kimmage piece if they get stuck into something. But that's what I like about David is he will take stories like that of, you know, a tragedy or an underdog, and he will investigate it.
The sensitivity with which it's told is a skill that not many have, but it's so delicate, and the detail within it to draw the story out and draw you in as a reader as well amidst the tragedy is an incredible skill. And I suppose it's fair enough to say he's in the autumn of his career, but he hasn't lost an iota of his dexterity. It's an incredible article, and I suspect, Brendan, you're probably right, we'll hear more on it. Much more frivolous things elsewhere, including John Ram rejecting a Ryder Cup spot. Essentially, this is Robert Gorman in the Mail on Sunday. Rebel Rams, Ryder Cup dynasty rejects peace deal. So the DP World Tour have sanctioned tour members who play in unsanctioned events, obviously, and this is sort of a long-running thing. Several players here, and specifically in the case of Liv, obviously, several players here, Tyrrell Hatton and Tom McKibben amongst them. Robert Gorman writes, all have agreed to pay in full. Outstanding fines for breaches of tour regulations, participate in additional stipulated DP World Tour tournaments, and withdraw all pending appeals. The same deal was available to Ram, but he's chosen to pursue his appeal against his sanctions, and that is scheduled to be heard in the next few months. So, like, it's unthinkable in some ways that he wouldn't be at a dare next year, but maybe he's not thinking that way himself. Maybe he just suspects all this will play out, but it'd be a lesser event without him.
It would, yeah. And, you know, maybe he believes that he shouldn't have to pay the fines. I'm not sure why his, you know, his reasoning on why he wouldn't take the deal. Because if that's the deal that's been offered to work this out, well then, you know, let bygones be bygones and move on to...
Particularly given that he was so critical of the whole thing before he eventually jumped ship.
This is just what I cannot get my head around with John Ram. I just can't. Like, the fact that he criticised it to the extent he did, he was a major winner. His form has clearly dropped off after he decided to make the move. I just can't understand it.
We'll mention there's a few other pieces that we want to touch on. We have Kevin Kilbane. Where are you, Kevin? The Sunday Times here, page 10.
Kevin Kilbane. Huh? The beloved Kevin.
Beloved Kilbane. Kids, almost must go before his name. And a regular consumer of the Sunday Paper Review from Canada. So good morning or afternoon to you, Kevin. Hello Magazine was the most embarrassing thing I've done, he says. Former international Kevin Kilbane talks about finding love on a TV show and his new life in Canada. And I know he'll be absolutely delighted of that photograph of himself and his now wife in their dancing gear all those years ago. He's never been more comfortable in his own skin, writes Paul Rowan here. And then quotes about lifestyle features, which his wife Brianna still likes to do from time to time. It was the most uncomfortable, embarrassing thing I've ever done. She loves the glamour. She's pleading with me. I've been offered to do this. Will you do it? I'm like, no, I'm not doing it. When your wife tells you, do it for me, then away you go. And that is Kevin Kilbane in a nutshell there. But he is he's back and off the ball, by the way, for everybody who needs to know that information. I'm happy enough to cross-sell this piece of information. He's back and off the ball. And as Orla rightly says, the most beloved person that we have in the country are up there anyway.
110 Ireland caps and an Irish record, 66 competitive games in a row. Mark Kilbane out as one of Ireland's most committed players. And he talks in the piece about how he is more comfortable in his identity now and loves Ireland and is more invested than he's ever been.
And is researching about the Fenians and the Orange Men in his local town is a bastion of the Orange tradition.
Right.
I just a piece, Adrian, that struck me. If I connect probably two or three pieces together, the Indo has a piece with Ger Ryan, who's running for the GA presidency in a couple of weeks' time. Congress is on, to link that with one of the things Ger Ryan is quoted as saying, the governance demands on club officers is much more significant now, he says. And I have a link that John Green has a piece at the back of the Indo on a row in a club in Dunboyne.
Tennis club, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, I think more and more of that's beginning to come out now. There's a whole safeguarding, and there's a more demanding set of parents coming through now, and the pressure on volunteers who run clubs in every sport must be, you know.
Well, there's a lot of
really demanding.
There's trying to find the balance between the administrative loopholes that a club in Dublin has run aground of and has caused consternation amongst most other clubs with the safeguarding, vetting side of things, which, you know, needs to be done. It's the balance of not burdening people with the administrative side while ensuring safety, obviously being the priority.
Yeah, it's difficult. A real challenge now in the sense of, well, one of them, I mean, Peter Horgan in the GA has done a fantastic piece of work on their demographics report, which is applicable right across the country to every sport. But you now have a situation with, particularly in the urban areas, the clubs are bursting with numbers and they're struggling to field teams. So now you have this whole area of kids not able to get games. You know, I know incidents in Dublin here where parents have tried to get their children into different clubs, and there's waiting lists to get into clubs, and they're struggling.
And that's understandable too, because facilities and
Are going to be a huge issue.
I want to give one hat tip and then over to you, Orla, because I know you want to mention a piece as well. Mine is Mark Gallagher in the Mail on Sunday, victim blaming the most dangerous element of racism, commenting on the week that was for one Jose Mourinho and Vinicius Jr. obviously, and linking it back to the events as well that we had on our own doorstep only a week ago with the Irish rugby team. That's a piece we're checking out. And on the page before that, Orla.
Yeah, Ger Siggins, who is Ireland's foremost cricket journalist and a colleague of mine, has laid out a 7-point plan to save Irish cricket. He details how, you know, there's a number of sort of issues at the moment whereby we can't host haven't been hosting internationals here. There is a possibility of a drop off in the standard of player going into the international men's team because there's pathways problems and, you know, sort of bringing in maybe project players, as we would term them. Sarah Keane is about to take up her role as CEO of Cricket Ireland, and as a woman with an incredible track record in turning around underperforming organisations, there's certainly a lot for her to get stuck into. And Ger just lays out 7 points here that really need to be addressed and what needs to be looked at. Like, I know there's people mightn't think it, but there is a huge constituency of Irish cricket aficionados out there. So if people want to read that, it's up on the Mail Online website as well, or in the paper.
A lot of stuff that I think will be easily transferable to other sports as well.
Yeah.
John Crawford in YouTube, Eamon Cregan, last outside manager in hurling, and John O'Mahony in football. This is the sort of thing that motivates people to the nth degree, Brendan, to make sure that it's absolutely right. Really enjoyed that conversation over the last hour and 20 minutes or thereabouts. Thanks a million. Orla McElroy, thank you. Brendan Haggart.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks a lot. That's the Sunday Papers for today.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Centra. Kick off with a cold one. Over 18s only. Drink responsibly. Get the facts. Visit drinkaware.ie.
This is News Talk.